Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us here on The Mark Steiner Show. And we begin this conversation talking about a man who changed the nature of how we listen to jazz, changed the nature of audio recording, brought a microphone in from Germany called the Neumann U47 condenser that changed the way that audio was done. The first man in America to do that. His name was Rudy Van Gelder. And he died at 91 years old. Just the other day, and he was, last week I should say, and he played with all the greats. And let me just give you a taste. This is a taste, and we'll talk about why we're playing this. It's one of the old recordings by a man you know, because you hear him on the station, named Miles Davis. So we're here with Robert Shahid, co-host of the Baltimore Blend, longtime musician and drummer, Wal Matthews, composer, performer, teacher, and one of the great music audio engineers in our world, who I've worked with for many years. Good to have you both in the studio.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Absolutely.
You know, I know you have a lot to share, but you mentioned something early on about Rudy Van Gelder bringing the Neumann U47, which was a microphone that he actually used up until his passing. But the unique thing about it was that when that microphone came out and they began using it in the United States, other studios couldn't use it correctly because the technology in the United States hadn't caught up with that technology over.
It was German
that's right.
Equipment, right.
Only Rudy Van Gelder was able to develop the preamplifier that actually worked with the U47, and that made his sound so much better. While others were tinkering around with it, he was the guy who actually recognized, because he had such great ears, that there was something wrong with the preamplifiers. They were using United States preamplifiers with the European U47. And I'm telling you what, he made the difference just by recognizing that. And eventually he imported the proper preamplifier that made that thing work correctly.
Wow. So while as an audio engineer, I mean, we talk about how he mic'd these things and how he actually changed how we listen to hear jazz.
Right. He was very secretive about that.
Yes, absolutely.
I just heard a story about him from a friend of mine who's a radio person up in New York at WFMU, and her husband is named Peter Keepnews. He's the son of Orrin Keepnews, who was the other great engineer at the same time as Van Gelder, and competitor, I guess you would say. And Bobby Hutcherson, who had just passed away also recently, told them the story that he went with Keepnews to record at Van Gelder's studio. And when they finished, Keepnews was like, well, let's take the tape because I'll master it. And reluctantly, Van Gelder gave it to him and said, okay, but you're not going to understand it, I guarantee it. So they left, they went back, and after a while, Keepnews said, you know, he's right, I don't understand it. And they had to take it back for him to master it.
So, take it back to the original.
Because he just had a very secretive way that nobody really knew what he did.
But I think not only was it secretive, we have to recognize the time that he started out. As a teenager in high school, his father played drums.
And he
played a little drums, and he played trumpet also.
Right, trumpet, right.
So he had
right.
developed an ear for how accurate these instruments should sound. But he was also into technology. He used to go to do, you remember the Heath kits?
Mm-hmm.
He used to put these Heath kit electronic kits together, all because he wanted the sound to be perfect. A lot of engineers, and I know that you know some of the youngsters, they like this, they approach engineering from the standpoint of who is the manufacturer, and the manufacturer sells them on what they should use in order to reproduce sound. Van Gelder approached it a different way. He wanted the sound to be accurate. He was recording his teenage kids in the teenage high school bands and all of that. But he was an optometrist by trade.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting thing to see how his love of music and recording, because he didn't get into producing groups. He didn't put together groups. He just concentrated on accurate recording. And he did that all the way through his high school, the high school bands, and of course now we know he did all the great jazz musicians. And I have always said that I put him in the same classification as the musicians he recorded, because you could absolutely hear the difference. I know as a drummer growing up, and I'm going to stop talking. As a drummer growing up, I never heard how magnificent the Gretsch drum jazz kits could sound until I heard the way Rudy Van Gelder recorded it on Tony Williams' Spring. And that it was just a magnificent sound. And he never shared how he did it.
Right. No. I say this all the time. When you're recording music, the tracking and what you record is equivalent to photography of creating the negative. And I look at Van Gelder as sort of the Ansel Adams of recording, in that he simplified it on one hand. He caught the actual image that was in the air and made such a great negative from that it was able to be reproduced, similar to the way Adams photographs just stand out in black and white.
Good comparison.
And he had no idea, I think, at the time that he was creating these documents, these audio historical documents that would go on to reshape music in all fields for decades to come and will continue to do so.
Well, you know, he shared that in the early days, recording studios actually recorded from the same kind of mixing board that radio stations had.
Right.
So he had to get into it with his thirst for technological advancement and actually rewire these radio station mixing boards to actually accommodate what he wanted to hear coming through his system and record. And now he was one of the few that not only recorded as an engineer, but he mastered his works himself. He couldn't see turning over his recorded work to another shop to master it, because he knew he was the one that knew what it was supposed to sound like.
He also, when you look at back, he was, in many ways, he was the sound of Blue Note. He was the sound of Verve. He was the sound of CTI.
Prestige.
And Prestige. You know, he was a magician with what he caught that way. There's a musician in this area named Joe Orange, who's a trombone player, played with Archie Shepp, among other people, and recorded Fire Music at Van Gelder's studio with Archie Shepp. Now, we think of Van Gelder as basically Blue Note and very accessible melodic jazz. Archie Shepp is, you know,
yes, he is.
We've taken it out to a, you know,
right.
We're taking you out, we may not bring you back, so strap in. And Joe said, I said, well, how was it there? He said, you know what? He was just nothing but professional. There was very little interaction. He was transparent to the process.
You know, the way he mic'd things and edited things, when you can hear, there was a piece that he did, Blue Train.
Yes.
Right? And when he did Blue Train and with Coltrane, you know, the way he brought in Paul Chambers' bass and Lee Morgan's, you know, together, and how they ended one and began the other, how they melded. I mean, he changed the nature of how we hear jazz, but I would say in a LaBarta sense, music.
Yes, right.
Just because of how he was able to manipulate sounds. He said about himself that he was a like a photographer. It doesn't just take pictures of the images, as you were saying before,
huh,
right?
I didn't know that. Huh.
He said a photographer creates what he wants you to see. And that's how he did what he did with his music.
Right.
He created images he wanted to hear. Right. He wanted you to hear.
Right.
And he did that by respecting the very beautiful sonic qualities of the instruments themselves and how to place mics in a certain place. One of the studio things that people remember about Rudy Van Gelder when you're in his studio is, don't touch the mic.
Right. Right.
Don't touch the mic.
Don't touch that mic.
Right.
If you ever want to get him with a wrinkle in his brow, don't touch the mic. Because there's unique places that you place the mic that have not only an effect on how the instrument is recorded, but how it affects the other mics in that area.
That's right.
And he knew how to do that, not necessarily because he read it or he got it from some recording engineering book, because he wanted the perfect sound and he worked with it until he was able to find it.
You know, it's interesting. And folks, do join us at 410-319-8888. This is a jazz station, as you know, and we're talking about one of the men who created modern American jazz in terms of the sound. And the funny, interesting thing I was reading about this, Van Gelder died on Wayne Shorter's 83rd birthday.
Yeah, right. I saw that.
Right?
Yeah.
You see that?
Yeah,
I didn't see that. That's interesting.
And so, you know, Speak No Evil is what
that Shorter was one of his studios?
That's right. '64.
Right. All of Shorter's solo albums
and Herbie Hancock's
were all recorded.
And Grayson Moncourt III and Lee Morgan. And,
right. Mm. I'll tell you something very
interesting. Sidewinder.
Yes.
And I think what's ironic and fitting all at once is that, you know, these days there's so much going on with samples, using samples and things. And I think one of the reasons is because there's a hunger for a sound that was created specifically. Every studio had its own sound. Every mic created its own. So every recording has its own audio vibe, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So he created this incredible resource of samples that Blue Note was smart enough to go, you know what, let's let these guys go in here. And all of a sudden, you've got Tribe Called Quest, you've got Notorious B.I.G., mm-hmm. you've got all these samples are starting to come out and be reused and recycled in a way that gives a new perspective.
Yeah.
And he remains invisible in the process. They have no clue that he was the guy that actually created that for them. And
that's interesting.
And so he continues to live forward that way.
His excellence in recording music has such an influence on musicians. I remember my sons growing up when we used to play for them the Count Basie records, and he never gained an appreciation for those records until I took them to hear the band live. And then they recognize it doesn't sound like those poor engineers recorded those tunes back in those days. The big band is quite a sound. Well, Rudy Van Gelder, because of his accuracy of recording, you got for the first time to hear just how magnificent these jazz ensembles really sounded. And you didn't have to be disappointed. You know, people are turned off by music when it's not recorded correctly.
Right.
And Rudy Van Gelder bridged that gap. And I think that's a big contribution.
And one thing he said that I think people would be shocked, surprised, and scratch their heads over is that he loved the digital process, embraced it, and said that recording LPs was such an inferior process. You had to work so hard to get the music where it needed to be. Digital made it so much easier. And he said, if you don't like the sound of the recording digitally, don't blame the medium, blame the engineer.
Ooh. Ouch.
You know, that's exactly right. And we are all surprised that he embraced digital music that quickly.
Well, and I was about to say that. What he did was, I mean, even though he left Blue Note after Blue Note shifted, and went to CTI,
right?
Yep.
Where they did great jazz work at CTI. He then went back and digitized all the old Blue Note stuff. He did it.
He did
it. So he didn't get stuck.
Painstaking.
He didn't get stuck in the old medium.
Right.
And those of us who are collectors, we had fun listening to, how can we hear the difference that Rudy heard from that album that we first got?
Right.
And his digitally remastered by RVG, as he used to put on there, by Rudy Van Gelder. And the subtleties were there. He didn't over condense anything or over change anything, but you can hear that he just enhanced slightly but magnificently the appreciation of what he had already originally recorded.
Right. Absolutely.
Well, I think the first thing I point to with Van Gelder in terms of jazz history and jazz is A Love Supreme.
Mm. Right.
I mean, you know, considered by
John Coltrane,
quite a few people to be the greatest jazz album ever.
I had this. Well, this is a digression. Arguing with my brother, who I love, who's also a musician, he's a conga player, said that Brubeck had the most influence of anybody. And that's because that's the only station the white folks would play.
Okay.
They wouldn't play Love Supreme.
We understand
and
how you got to that.
Monk, right? I interviewed Brubeck 5 times.
Oh, yeah, and he's a great guy.
Amazing musician, incredible genius, lovely human being.
And a social activist,
mm-hmm. lovely human being. But he never recorded with Van Gelder, did he? No, he didn't.
I don't know.
He didn't. And Columbia was a different animal. I wish we could talk about how drastic the difference is, but this is about Rudy.
Well, no, but that was part of it because of Rudy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, if you can describe for our listeners what it means, both as musician and recording engineer, and you're also a musician and composer, both, what Van Gelder meant, but how did he really change the nature of how we hear the music, do you think?
Well, I think what he did was he was able, his focus was always on what does the musician want this to be. And he was totally selfless in that. So he was focusing purely in a non-egotistic way on capturing this particular sound, and his expertise that this gentleman was talking about how to use the technology combined with that selflessness, get-out-of-the-way attitude, created a sound that we'd never heard before, and now it lives as if it's right in the room with you. He talked about why he likes 5.1 so much.
What does that mean?
Meaning that when you can put the speakers, you have 5 speakers surrounding you, surround sound. He said, now for the first time, you can hear what I heard. You can hear the trumpet is over there. The bass is over here. You can get that. And so I think that's how, you know, none of that would exist without him.
That's absolutely true, and I appreciate what you're saying. Idris Muhammad, who was known as Leo Morris back in the days when he was with Blue Note, always wanted his drums to sound a certain way. And most engineers will agree that drums are the hardest things to record because of all the sonic abilities.
Right.
And I always compare what you heard the drums sound like on what was done at Atlantic on Giant Steps, mm-hmm. where they were muffling the cymbals with a piece of tape and putting a big piece of mat on the drums, as opposed to what Rudy Van Gelder did. And he used to ask Idris Muhammad, or Leo Morris as he was known at that time, how do you want your snare to sound?
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. And when he described that and played it for him, he said, I don't want these overtones to be lost because that's a part of the drum. And Rudy Van Gelder was able to match the right mic that did that and put it in the right position. So it sounded like Leo Mars wanted it to sound. That's the difference. Musically, when a musician can walk away and say, that's the way I heard it. In fact, it's even better.
Right.
You know, the Hammond B3, Jimmy Smith was recorded all the time at Van Gelder Studio. That's a hard instrument to record.
Jimmy Smith? I didn't know about Jimmy Smith.
Yeah. Oh, Jimmy Smith. Oh, yeah. All those great Jimmy Smith with Kenny Burrell.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Wow. And Kenny Burrell was known in the Rudy Van Gelder Studios for having one of the cheapest amps. And it always had some kind of buzz in it. Rudy Van Gelder was able to run Kenny Burrell's amp through a system of his own electronic manufacturer. To get rid of the hum that never came out, even when Kenny Burrell was playing live.
I mean, it is remarkable to hear these recordings today with the enhanced ability we have where any flaw would be seen or heard, and they're immaculate.
You know, let me tell you, a lot of the engineers today, they take their finished product and they go out in the car to see how it sounds mm-hmm. when the public uses it through their regular systems. Well, you can imagine back in those days, there were no CD players in the cars, no cassette players either. Rudy Van Gelder made, because he's a ham radio expert, he made a ham radio frequency that would broadcast to his little tinny car speakers so that he could take his product and play it in the studio and go out in his car and hear it, just like we hear the CDs now, because of his technology. And he grasped that.
I would equate him, even though he said he was not a producer, he was only an engineer, the labels produced, and that was not his job. I would equate him in many ways as important to music in his field as George Martin was to the Beatles.
I think you're exactly right. That's a big one.
And it's because we don't, I always think of jazz as America's classical music.
Mm-hmm, it
right?
is.
It is.
But America doesn't, a lot of America doesn't get that. I think, right?
Right.
And that's why we haven't heard of Van Gelder. I mean, why most people don't know who he is, which is why I think, especially in a station like ours, we have to kind of really honor what he did.
That's the value of WEA in the Mark Steiner Show. Show appreciation for those things that people overlook.
I mean, he was somebody, I mean, you know, growing up in Hackensack and just became part of it. I mean, I was going to end the show with this, but it's in my head now. I mean, it's like, you know, there was a thing he did, I read about it the other day, about how everybody would say before they got ready to hit the beat with him in the studio, Ready Rudy. Everybody knew that.
That's right.
Ready Rudy.
Ready Rudy.
Ready Rudy.
Mm-hmm.
I think that became a track. I think one of the musicians
Miles
wrote
Davis,
it.
Right?
I don't think it was Miles. I think it was another guy, but he wrote a track, Ready Rudy, because of that. Right?
You know? What I'm trying to say is here, when you hear jazz live,
yes,
it's different than hearing a recording.
Oh, absolutely.
So how much do you think what he did to our way we listen to music?
Well, that's interesting to say that. Go ahead.
The thing about jazz, though, especially what he did, is they are live performances. They only did one or two takes, and they were
that's
gone.
Interesting. Right.
And
right.
so they weren't captured. In different cubicles.
Right. Right. They weren't in headphones with isolation. That came later, and he actually supported that. He said, "Why wouldn't you want that?" But what he did was in that era where everything was in what we call mono, not stereo.
Mono. That's important.
Right. And it was all live performances, and very much the way Bob Dylan still records. We'll do a couple of takes. We get the best one. We're moving on. We ain't laboring over this.
Yeah, and to be able to do that in one or two takes maximum. And come out with the clarity that he did without the interference that you normally would expect somebody to get.
Right.
Was it Mac? And part of that had to do with the acoustics of his mother's living room
in Hackensack, New Jersey.
In Hackensack, New Jersey. But the other thing you have to remember that he mastered that technique so well that he was the one that recorded all the live sessions at places like the Village Vanguard Train
Birdland.
And all the other ones because he knew how. And he used to say it takes 3 days to do a live recording. One day to disassemble all those great layouts he had in his studio. Another day to set that up at the live place. And, of course, the day of the recording.
Of course, one thing he worked at to a great disadvantage that we don't realize is we think of jazz as like, okay, it starts at 8 or 9 at night. It goes till 3 or 4 in the morning. All of those sessions were recorded between 9 and 5 during the daytime. So to get jazz musicians coming in at 9 o'clock in the morning and get those kind of performances is pretty amazing.
That's tough. So let me go to the phones, get a quick call in here, and we're going to leave you out. We're listening to a little Love Supreme right now.
Oh, excellent.
But we're going to jump into the piece that Thelonious Monk did to honor him called Hackensack, which is where he recorded in New Jersey. So Thelonious wrote this piece, Hackensack, right. We're going to hear on the way out of here. But let's go to the phone. CeCe Ryder, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hello. I'm just calling to say I miss the jazz that they used to have down there, the famous ballroom.
Oh, yes. Me too. Yes, indeed, CeCe. Yes.
And I remember seeing Jimmy Smith and Jimmy McGriff getting down together.
Yes.
On that organ.
Yes.
And then we had Miles Davis. We used to have a lot of famous people used to come to Baltimore.
Yep.
By the famous ballroom. And I just called to let you know that I'll be glad if they could start back up over again. That's what I
See, I, you know, I remember that place so well. I mean, it was...
I do, too.
You know, you would just come
every
down...
Every Sunday afternoon.
Sunday afternoon, people bring their food and hang out. They have setups. You bring your own booze and hang out. And,
mm-hmm.
That's right.
You could bring your kids.
You could bring your kids. It was very family-friendly.
Family-friendly right? Place to be.
Oh, man, that was a spot.
Where are those tapes?
Yeah, that's right.
Where are those
well, that's
tapes?
A good question because they are all around.
They got to be somewhere, right? There's a whole legacy there.
James Fowler tapes. Knows where they are. James, if you're listening, you ought to call us.
Let's
and tell
go
us.
See James Fowler knocking his
that's
door.
That's right.
I think
thank you, see.
I'm not 100% sure, but I'm pretty sure that Coltrane's last performance was at the famous ballroom.
Oh, man. Wouldn't that be something
I think that is true.
And also the famous was the place before segregation ended. It was one of the few places in Baltimore where black and white folks gathered together.
That's right. That's absolutely
correct. It was the famous ballroom.
Yeah. And it was so easy to book musicians because they could get off Amtrak right there at Penn Station and actually walk up to the famous and go back to New York where they were hanging out.
Yeah.
Right.
So it was in a Sunday afternoon. There was no competition for any other performance. So
right.
Left Bank had everybody. Tony Williams, Miles Davis, Stan Getz, Jay Brubeck, Jimmy Smith, as she mentioned on the phone. Everybody.
Yeah, man. And it made me think, we got to end here in a minute, but I want you to include a closing thought from both of you. We're listening to Hackensack right now by Thelonious. But on Sunday mornings, you know, there was the Ethical Society, which was a semi-religious place where blacks and whites would gather. And from there, you could go from the Ethical Society on down to the famous ballroom and have
a Sunday, there's a funny story about this Hackensack. When
tell it real fast.
Thelonious Monk and Miles Davis were in the same studio together with Rudy Van Gelder. And Miles Davis asked Thelonious Monk, please lay out on my solo. I don't want you tinkering around on my solo. So when Miles started soloing and Van Gelder was recording, Thelonious Monk just stood up and leaned over top of it. And when he finished, Miles said, why you do that? He said, well, you just told me to lay out. You didn't say I had to stay out.
right.
That's a Van Gelder story. Yeah, I didn't tell the story. Van Gelder did.
Rudy Van Gelder. So, closing thoughts. Especially, I mean, as a man who composes music and has spent his life doing music and recording music.
Well, for Van Gelder, I think, like I said before, the legacy of what he created and how it lives today. You could go back and listen to those recordings, and as a musician and a composer who wants to study the music, you can hear everything so clearly that you can learn just from the recordings. It's like having the great teachers right in your living room working with you.
As a musician, I think I can appreciate him so greatly because as a musician, you approach your music trying to express something of beauty that's within you to the people outside of you so that they know what you really feel and what you really see. For the first time, I think there was a recording engineer who tried to approach his craft in the same way, not following somebody else's instructions, but to depict what he heard in the most accurate way so that others would appreciate it.
I want to thank you both. This has been great. Robert Shahid, co-host of the Baltimore Blend, longtime musician, drummer, incredible human being, and he and I are going to jump up with a project for you all in the next couple months.
Oh, yeah.
We'll leave that in the... quietly, we'll let you know when it's happening. We got something in store for you. Walt Matthews, composer, performer, teacher, and great audio engineer, ran Clean Cuts Music Audio for 20-some years, and also was composer of the Mark Steiner Show theme music. I'm
glad
that as well.
One of my great pleasures.
Thank you both, brothers, for being
here.
Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us, Mark.
We can take a short break and come back, and when we come back, it'll be time to check out what's happening in our city with a couple of people running to become your next city councilman. Stay with us.